Now, our second speaker today is Dr. Timothy Bartek. He's a senior economist with a well-respected and independent W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research at Kalamazoo, Michigan. He's been there 20 years. His B.A. is in political philosophy from Yale. His Ph.D. is in economics from the University of Wisconsin here at Madison. He is said to be one of the country's leading experts on what works and what doesn't in economic development policy being implemented in states across the country. He's published more than 50 books, journal articles, academic publications on regional economics, public finance, urban and labor economics. And one of his books was named among the most noteworthy books in industrial relations and labor economics by the Industrial Relations section of Princeton University. He's written several grants to support and received several grants to support his research and writing. He's a popular speaker. He says he could be speaking all the time, so you have to kind of strong arm a little bit to get him to come. So he speaks at the National Governors Association, the Midwest Council of State Governments, the National Association of State Development Agencies, and in most states in the Midwest. Dr. Bartek tells me he enjoys coming to Wisconsin. He met his wife here while he was in graduate school. And when they first met, they each thought the other was too young to date. And if they dated, they'd be accused of robbing the cradle. So to solve the problem of looking too young, he grew a beard, which he said, you know, made him look a little bit older and eliminated a morning task that he always found kind of annoying. So he still got that beard today. And he also tells me he has some special insight into policymaking. He just has served on the Kalamazoo School Board for 8 years. And he says he can identify with any of you in the audience who've had the experience of being attacked as a knave, a fool, or part of a conspiracy. I don't know if that happens to any of you. His topic today is what works in state economic development policy. Thanks a lot for coming, Dr. Bartek.
Thank you. Is this working okay? Can people hear me? This is relatively easy. As I was saying, I recently went through the experience. After I stepped off the school board, they asked me to chair the redistricting task force for the school district. I don't know if anybody has ever been involved with redistricting a school district. It's not a way to make yourself popular. And I did not become a popular person as a result of this. I'd like to thank the Family Impact Seminar for inviting me to do this. It's been interesting reading about Wisconsin again after not being here for really for any length of time, for 30 years. And talking to people about what's going on in Wisconsin and trying to learn from that experience in terms of my own work. What I'm going to do today is mainly the second item on this list. What's the evidence on what economic development programs work the best? They're most effective in promoting economic development. However, that's the second item on this list here. To do that, I'm going to first have to introduce this by trying to say what we're talking about. What is economic development? Because, you know, you could say it's everything state government does because everything affects the economy, and that's not a very helpful definition. And finally, I want to close with some observations on Wisconsin's programs based on, admittedly, somewhat cursory knowledge. But let me turn to the first thing. What are we talking about when we talk about state economic development policies? As I said, you could define it as everything state government does. Everything affects the economy. A lot of times, though, people narrow it down and focus on policies that economic development policy or policies that are aimed at increasing job growth. And I think that's an okay definition. I prefer a somewhat different definition, that economic development policies are policies to increase the earnings per capita of state residents. Now, you might say that's a distinction without a difference. After all, job growth typically does increase earnings per capita. But not all job growth is equal. Not all job growth is equally effective increasing earnings per capita. A lot depends on what the wages are of those jobs and what proportion of those jobs go to state residents. So, for example, if the job growth is particularly low wage, the impact on earnings per capita will be reduced considerably. Could even be zero. If the jobs brought in are very, very low wage, it could have actually a zero effect on earnings per capita. And similarly, if none of the jobs go to current Wisconsin residents, it's not going to drive up the employment to population ratio. One thing to think about when you think about job growth, logically, when you increase the number of jobs in the state, there are only two ultimate consequences of that. either the employment to population ratio goes up or the population goes up. They have to be accommodated in one of two ways. When jobs are created, either it has to result in some people in the state who otherwise would not be employed becoming employed, or it has to result in new people coming to the state. There are no other possibilities ultimately. Now, in the short run, you know, if someone comes in a state, they create 100 jobs, maybe they hire those people from people in the state who already are employed. But then that creates vacancies in those jobs in the state. Those vacancies have to be filled again by either someone who is non-employed, someone who is already employed in the state, or someone new to the state. One of those three possibilities. There's a whole chain of vacancies that are created. Ultimately, those vacancies have to be filled either by employing someone in the state who otherwise would not be employed, or by bringing someone new to the state. There are no other possibilities. Now, from the point of view of a state government or the public, there are far fewer social benefits of bringing new people to the state, certainly from a fiscal standpoint. You bring new people to the state, there are high service costs, high expenditure costs. It generally tends to be a fiscal loser from a state perspective. And in any event, you're not providing jobs for the people in the state who need them most. So from a benefit cost standpoint, you would much prefer increasing providing jobs to people in the state who otherwise would not be employed over bringing new people to the state. So, you know, the key argument is we need to think about economic development not as simply increasing job growth, but increasing earnings per capita. That means we need to care not only about how many jobs we create, but what wage rates they have and who gets the jobs. Now, given that definition that economic development policies are policies that increase the earnings per capita of state residents, in my view, there really shouldn't be much of a distinction made between state economic development policy and state labor market policy. I mean, earnings per capita is a labor market outcome. It's an outcome of labor markets. You can increase earnings per capita in a state either by attacking the demand side of the labor market or the supply side of the labor market. Either you interact in effective behavior of employers or potential employers, or you interact in effective behavior of workers or potential workers. You either increase the quantity and quality of jobs that employers provide, or you increase the quantity and quality of the labor supply of state residents. Now, my talk today will mainly focus on labor demand policies. And this is what I'm going to go through. I'm going to go through seven different labor demand policies and what the evidence shows on their effectiveness, and I'll briefly talk about one specific labor supply policy. Okay, first labor demand policy I want to talk about is financial and tax incentives. Nationally, this is probably the most important quantitative type of policy. What are examples of this? Property tax abatements. A company comes in your state, you don't charge it the normal property tax rate on its property. Or alternatively, you provide various types of investment tax credits, or you provide tax credits based on the personal income tax revenues generated by the new workers. So those are some examples of that. As I said, nationally that's the most important. It's not clear to me that's true in Wisconsin. I'll get back to that later. Now, what do we know about these? Well, they can work. They tend to be relatively expensive. Why are they relatively expensive per job created? Couple reasons. One, there are a lot of other costs that vary a great deal across states, most notably labor cost. And what is relevant for a company is not only the price of labor, but the productivity of labor. There are enormous variations across states in the price and productivity of labor. If you look at what the average tax incentive, financial incentive that states offer in the U.S., it ends up adding up to less than $1 per hour of labor. So what that means is your state can be offering this incentive, and if some other state, either the price of labor goes down by $1 per hour or the productivity of labor goes up by $1 per hour, that's completely offsets offering the incentive. So there are these huge variations in other costs. You're offering relatively modest incentives. It ends up not affecting behavior that much. In fact, simulations indicate that out of every 100 companies that are offered the typical state and local financial incentive package that are offered it, and come to the state, only four of them would not have otherwise come to the state. So what you're doing is you're offering, you're giving this incentive package, 100 companies located in your state, 96 of those companies would have located in your state anyway. You are affecting four of them. 96 you're not affecting. Now you might say, well, gee, why don't we just offer it to those four? Well, unless you have a ready supply of mind readers in your state who you can hire in your State Department of Commerce, you're not likely to get very far in that strategy. It's very, very hard to tell whether an incentive is really needed to be decisive. So what you have to realize is that there's this enormous cost that you have, in order for incentives to work, you have to offer the incentives to all 100. There's a cost to the 96 that is very great for getting those four companies to create jobs in your state. It ends up being that the cost of creating a job through financial incentives is about, in present value terms, equivalent to about $200,000 per job. Now, that's a very big number. It may still be worth it. I should emphasize that there can be very high social benefits of job creation, and we can get into that a little later on what some of those are, but it could be worth it, but it is expensive. Now, there is some evidence that financial incentives are more effective if they're more targeted at, one, high-quality jobs, higher-wage jobs, jobs that involve hiring the unemployed, and particularly job creation in small and medium-sized businesses, existing businesses in your state. Bill already mentioned the Mead program in Minnesota. If we, at some point during questions, we can get into talking about that. I don't have time to get into it now, but it was a program that essentially was targeted in those ways, and there's some sign that that kind of targeting makes the program have a higher social benefit cost ratio. Second type of program, labor demand program that state and local areas sometimes use, is customized job training. Customized job training it's usually provided around the country through what usually are called community colleges, but what I understand in Wisconsin are called technical colleges. And essentially, it's training that's offered to a firm that either is locating a state, expanding in a state, or is considering leaving or downsizing to try to retain jobs, where you provide job training that to some extent is customized that individual company's needs. There are a variety of programs around the country. North Carolina, actually, where Bill's from, is actually considered one of the leading states in this area. There are some states that finance this through add-ons to their unemployment insurance tax. For example, Massachusetts and California both do this. The evaluation evidence on customized job training suggests that per dollar spent, it's about at least 10 times more effective than just offering cash. Now, why would it be so effective? That seems kind of odd. Why such a high, why is it so much more effective offering a company customized job training compared to just giving them cash? Well, first of all, a customized job training assistant comes up front right away. Companies, corporate location decision makers have very high discount rates on the future. A lot of tax abatements that are provided, it's hard to believe that the tax abatement you provide, you give a company a property tax abatement for 20 years. The tax abatement for years 11 through 20 does not play a key role in the decisions of a corporate decision maker who probably doesn't expect to be employed by that company 5 years from now. Therefore, you're kind of giving away future tax revenue, which is convenient because, you know, you don't have to worry about it, maybe, but it doesn't probably affect the decisions very much. Customized job training is upfront assistance. In addition, we know that companies have a great deal of problems finding skilled workers. There are estimates that perhaps 1/4 of all new hires don't work out for companies. Very expensive. Worker turnover is very expensive. You can provide high-quality workers. That's an extraordinarily valuable incentive. Another advantage of customized job training, if you provide cash, there's always the issue of can you claw back the cash if the company leaves? Can you recover it? Customized job training, to some extent, has automatic clawback, and that presumably most of the workers will stick around if the company leaves. So you have those workers. Presumably, you can attract other companies with the same workers. Now, as you know, Bill was mentioning first source programs. One advantage of customized job training, it can sometimes be tied to so-called first source programs, where you essentially tell a company, if we give you these various incentives, whatever, will you agree to consider workers referred via the local workforce development system as the first source for entry-level jobs? Man, I want to emphasize this is consider. In general, when state and local governments have tried to require some quota system where you have to hire locally or have to hire certain people, that, if anything, is a disincentive. In practice, these things are practically never enforced because it's such a disincentive that no one really wants to enforce them. It's just something that someone enacts at some point. It's a symbolic thing, and no one ever tries to enforce them because it's too draconian. You get a lot further in this area if you use carrots rather than sticks, and the first source program is a kind of a carrot approach. Again, we can talk about this more. There are some interesting programs in Portland, Oregon, and Berkeley, California that do this. Third area of labor demand programs, manufacturing and business extension. Essentially, these are programs that provide free or low-cost advice to businesses to help them improve their business productivity and sales. A lot of these are funded or focused on manufacturing. Many of them receive funding from the Federal Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And as the name suggests, usually these programs emphasize manufacturing. These programs typically provide various types of advice both through their own staff, who might have a background in engineering or business planning or various areas. They also provide referrals to local consultants who are reliable. In some states, most notably Pennsylvania and Tennessee, these services are part of the extension service of the state university. And one thing some of those states do, particularly in Tennessee, is one of the referral options they do is they will essentially refer you to a faculty member at University of Tennessee with expertise in whatever the area the company's problem is in, and they will provide one or two free days of consulting from that faculty member. Beyond that, you have to pay some fee. So there's a mixture of, there's some fee revenue involved in these things. Now, what does the evidence show on the effect of these programs? A number of studies indicate that they have a very high bang for the buck. They tend to reduce business costs by about $3 per dollar you spend on these programs. There's considerable effects on increasing sales, reducing costs of assisted companies. Now, I should emphasize, this is one area where it's very crucial to understand this is not always job creation. In many cases, what you're doing is helping companies become more productive. You may not be creating any jobs. You're hopefully, though, helping the company be more competitive. You're helping retain jobs, and you're helping make those jobs be higher quality so the company can afford to pay higher wages. Fourth type of labor demand program I want to talk about is entrepreneurship training, small business development. Again, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with these kind of programs. This is done, you know, through a variety of programs around the U.S. Sometimes it's done through group classes, sometimes through individual one-on-one counseling. You know, some programs are focused more on potential entrepreneurs. Some programs are focused more on existing small businesses. Some are run through universities. Some are run through small business development centers. There are about 1,000 small business development centers around the U.S. They're funded in part by the U.S. Small Business Administration as well as state governments, in some cases, fees. Some of the services also are sometimes linked to physical properties called business incubators, which, in addition to providing business development advice, also provide some relatively low rents and some shared office services. Again, there are about 1,000, at least 1,000 business incubators nationally. Now, there's some very strong evidence of success of entrepreneurship training. In fact, in the area of economic development, there's the most evidence, the most rigorous evidence of success of entrepreneurship training over any other economic development program. It seems to increase the rate of small business startups by about one-third. Now, I've sometimes had people ask me, you can't train someone to be an entrepreneur. Well, that's true in the sense that not everyone wants to start and own and operate their own business. But among people who do have that desire and interest, you certainly can train them in better ways of figuring out how to plan their business, market their business, and run their business. And in fact, you know, one impact of entrepreneurial training sometimes is talking people out of starting a business, which can be a good thing if it's going to fail. Any event, entrepreneurs train very, very effective. Small business development center incubator is also some evidence of success. Fifth type of economic development program is providing information or, in some cases, some advocacy for companies, either existing businesses in the state or potential new businesses in the state. A lot of times this is done through business visitation programs. Bill referred to that. A lot of local economic development agencies, and in some cases state economic development agencies, have regular programs where they visit existing businesses in the state, find out what their problems are, try to find out what they're dealing with, and see if they can help or refer them to some help. In addition, of course, many state and local areas do a lot of business recruitment where they try to provide potential new business in the state with information on sites in the state. Now, as part of this, some of what goes on is some interaction with state and local regulatory authorities to help companies overcome problems with environmental permits, environmental regulations, zoning, and various things, that kind of advocacy. Again, these programs are pretty cheap. There is some evidence that they're pretty successful per dollar spent because they really are very cheap. They're particularly important for small and medium-sized businesses that don't have the resources to necessarily get all this information on their own. The help with dealing with state regulation, permits, and program requirements is especially important because it's something that, in fact, state and local agencies have some comparative advantage in providing, is information on how state and local government operates and who to talk to. And as Bill mentioned, business visitation programs are also a useful way of providing feedback on state issues. If you start hearing from a lot of businesses you visit the same problem over and over again, then maybe it reflects some underlying policy issue you need to resolve. Six is capital market assistance. Six labor demand program is capital market assistance. Again, wide variety of programs in which either the government directly provides loans or grants or capital investment, or the government indirectly encourages private sector financial institutions to provide such assistance. Now, the vast majority of capital assistance programs are not evaluated. And if you want, we can talk in questions about why that isn't the case. It's partly because they're hard to evaluate. There is some favorable evidence on some of these programs. I particularly like a program that are called capital access programs. And this is going to sound really weird in the current financial crisis, but essentially they subsidize banks to make lending to risky businesses. And does that still make sense today? Yes, it actually does, but that might be a hard case to make, but it actually does make some sense. And we could talk about how capital access programs work, what the design of those things are. There's also some pretty good evidence, SBA loan guarantees, revolving loan funds, business development financial institutions, all these have some favorable evidence of success. Capital assistance programs are sometimes hard for governments to directly run because the ideal capital assistance program will have an above normal rate of loss. And that is sometimes hard for governments to deal with, or say newspapers. I got called up, I remember one time some years ago, by Detroit News, and there was some loan program in Detroit that had a 20% loss rate, and they wanted to know what that mean was a bad program. I said, no, I really can't tell. I could tell you if the program's loss rate was 0%, it was a bad program, because then banks should be making the loans. I could tell you if it's 100% loss rate, it's a bad program. 20% loss rate is kind of hard to say, actually. I need to know more about the program. Seventh area I want to mention is high tech. Now, high tech, really, everything we've previously listed could be part of a high tech initiative if it was focused on high tech. So a high tech initiative typically would combine some type of help to potential entrepreneurs, financing, information on how to improve your productivity, consultation with engineering professors, consultation with business marketing people. Everything we've talked about could be part of a high-tech program. A lot of emphasis, a lot of concern is over technology transfer from your state universities, particularly if you have such a fine university as the University of Wisconsin. It's a big issue. What does the evidence show on high-tech programs? Well, the evidence seems to suggest that strategies in which you coordinate all these services. In other words, you don't just focus on technology transfer, or you don't just focus on capital market assistance, or you don't just focus on entrepreneurship training or providing information to existing businesses. You do all of these things at once, and you do them in a coordinated way. That seems to be more effective. A good model for that is Pennsylvania has a program called the Ben Franklin Technology Partners, very good model. We can talk about that some more, how that works. San Diego also is a useful model. Again, there are some things written up on how that works in some of my writings. In general, it needs to be understood that a lot of people think that the university's role in high tech is simply to have professors inventing things that some local business will then adopt and start up. In fact, a lot of the evidence suggests from several studies that the universities are actually more important in playing a role in high tech in the workers they train and the consulting they provide to existing businesses, that is at least as important, if not more so, than technology transfer as a role of state government, state universities in high tech. Now, there's a common principle of this in a lot of these successful labor demand programs. The ones that have the highest bang for the buck tend to be programs that involve information and training in one way or another. So, you know, customized job training, that's information skills for workers. Entrepreneurship training, that's information and skills for people who want to start a business. Manufacturing extension services, that's information from manufacturing companies that want to improve their sales and productivity. All of these are providing some type of information to some entity. Providing information is often very cheap, I mean, compared to the effects you get. In addition, interacting with small and medium-sized existing businesses, you often have a higher bang for the buck. Businesses that are in your state in some way are easier to sell and expanding in your state than businesses that are in your state that you want to come to the state. It's somewhat easier to do. And in many cases, small and medium-sized businesses have relatively straightforward barriers to success that, in fact, state and local agencies, economic development agencies, may be in a position to affect. On the other hand, very large companies trying to affect their behavior is much harder for economic developers to do. Doesn't mean that you don't want to provide financial incentives in any case to large businesses. I'm not trying to argue that. I'm just trying to argue that usually the bang for the buck is better on non-financial information and training services that are provided to small and medium-sized businesses. Finally, let me mention one labor supply program because it's something I've done research on. I've done some work over the last few years with Pew Charitable Trust on looking at early childhood education programs, and particularly preschool, as an economic development program. And by preschool, I want to emphasize we're talking about high-quality preschool, which means it's expensive. It's expensive because it has small class sizes, and it has well-paid, highly qualified teachers. So we're not talking about just any preschool program. This is an expensive one. And there's a lot of evidence from numerous studies that high-quality preschool will, in the long run, raise the labor force participation rates of your local workforce, will raise the wage rates and productivity of your local workforce. Well over half of the people you put through a preschool program will stay in your state. Probably a lot more than that, probably three quarters at least will stay in your state. There's a lot of evidence from studies of how businesses locate and expand that the quality of your labor supply is perhaps the number one location factor. So if it's not quite like if you build it, they will come. If you create the labor supply, yes, labor demand will respond to that. There is a considerable labor demand response to increased labor supply. And in fact, some of the simulations I've done suggest in the long run, per dollar spent, high-quality preschool creates about twice as many jobs as financials providing, say, property tax abatements to business. Of course, the problem is that the economic impact is delayed. I mean, you don't take four-year-olds in preschool and employ them the next year, okay? So, you're increasing the labor supply, but it's, 20 years later. So you have to have some pretty long time horizons to think about this. And again, as I said, you can do a similar analysis of other labor supply or job skills programs. Finally, let me just mention some, and here I'm, taking some risks because my knowledge of Wisconsin's economic development programs is currently based on four or five conversations and reading through the legislative audit reports, the legislative fiscal bureau reports, the Department of Commerce. I read through a lot of reports for this thing, hundreds and hundreds of pages of reports. But I certainly don't claim to be an expert on Wisconsin's programs, although I thought the reports were excellent information. One thing that's pretty clear from those reports is that Wisconsin, compared to most other states with which I'm familiar, places a lot less emphasis on costly financial incentives than the average state. Certainly it does compared to Michigan. I mean, Michigan and Wisconsin in this area are like completely different, I can assure you. Now, I don't think that's bad. I actually think Wisconsin's approach is preferable, but that's just something I noted. Wisconsin does all the programs I've mentioned. You have them. You have manufacturing extension services. You have customized job training. You have entrepreneurship training. You have small business development services. All that stuff you have. Here's the question that I would leave you with, though. It's not clear to me that these programs are either big enough or coordinated well enough or targeted well enough to really have a sizable enough impact on the Wisconsin economy. And we have to understand the challenge here. Each year, I mean, what's the size of the Wisconsin economy? I looked it up. The gross state product, the total output of goods and services in Wisconsin is about $232 billion a year. $232 billion a year. Now, I don't care how big a bang for the buck you get, if you are trying to affect that whale of $232 billion with a little minnow of a $1 million program, you know, any effect's going to be lost in rounding error in the state economy. You're not going to be able to see it. It doesn't mean it doesn't help specific businesses, specific workers. Sure, it helps specific people, but you're not going to notice it in terms of the overall earnings per capita, for example, which is my criteria for success. You're not going to see a higher earnings per capita noticeably for the state as a whole. So the question is, are they large enough, and are they linked together well enough? As I said, there's a lot of evidence that if these services are coordinated, they're more effective. So if you're able to provide a business, if you're able in a local economy not only to help entrepreneurs, but to help existing businesses, and you're able to provide not just financial capital of some sort, but also various information and training, if you're able to link them up with the local, in your case, technical college system, link them up with the faculty at the local university, if you're able to do all that in a coordinated way, you're likely to have a much higher impact. There's some synergy, in other words, between these programs. There's also an issue, and this came out of a conversation yesterday, of whether or not you're able to target the cases where you really make a difference. In other words, you know, one issue is there are a lot of people who might come to the state, either they're entrepreneurs or they're existing small businesses, and they have an issue. Well, in some cases, that's very straightforward to deal with, and there's no problem. I mean, there's an entrepreneur, they want to start up a little business, a restaurant or whatever, that's going to employ five people. And the type of assistance they get is pretty routine. You probably do a good job in that. The issue is, do you have a system where if someone either is an entrepreneur who has the potential of creating a business that could employ 300 or 500 people, or alternatively, you have someone who's currently running a business that employs 50 people, and potentially, if they get things together, could employ 500. The question is, does your state have the capability of rapidly scaling up and offering very high-value targeted assistance to that person? Also, does your state have the capability to recognize that when you intervene, this is what Bill commented on, you're not going to have a 1,000% batting average? Okay? Economic development is not a game where you can demand that there's no wastage. You are going to end up assisting people, and the assistance is going to obviously fail in a way that certainly could be made the subject of newspaper headlines. State did X, company went bankrupt. Okay, that was a failure. You have to have a system that is resilient enough to deal with the failures and recognize the overall successes. And finally, do the programs have a good enough feedback system? I appreciate that the Legislative Audit Bureau and the recent reports from the different agencies, there's some reporting requirements that have come in Wisconsin. The issue is this system, is there enough commonality in success measures across programs? Are all your programs being evaluated on the same success measures? You know, if the goal is increasing earnings per capita, for example, if that's what you want to define as a goal, are you able to actually measure where that's done? Is it being done in a systematic enough way across programs? That's another issue I would raise. I think you're moving in that direction. It's not clear to me that the state is there yet. Let me stop there, and I think you want to do like, how
five
do we do?
Questions.
5 minutes of questions, I guess.
Sure. We'll have you stay here for that. Yes, Representative
yes.
Townsend. Oh, we need to, we're taping this for legislators who drive long distances to the Capitol.
You brought up a very interesting situation in terms of the various types of of incentives are establishment of economic development zones. Have you ever addressed the problem? But from a legislative point of view, legislators are elected by thinking locally, but sure. As a legislator, they're also expected to react on a global basis. And it's a very difficult balancing act because you may reach the conclusion that it's beneficial to think in a global type of situation rather than locally, but oftentimes that doesn't gain you the local votes. And so my conclusion is many of these programs are diluted because you try to spread it too thinly and you lose the cost effectiveness or the effectiveness of the incentives. Can you comment on that?
Well, that can be a problem, particularly if you're trying to target distressed areas, which obviously the benefits of job growth are greater in distressed areas, and it is appropriate to target things. The one thing I would say, though, is depends how local you get. Ultimately, the way I think about economies, local economies are metropolitan areas. Local labor markets are metropolitan areas. Neighborhoods are not local economies. They're neighborhoods. They're places where people live, maybe do a little shopping. But most people in the U.S. do not work in the neighborhood they live in, nor necessarily should they. So you have to realize that in terms of creating jobs, what really matters for creating jobs is not how many jobs are created in your neighborhood, but how many jobs you're creating in your metropolitan area. I would certainly urge any state to make metropolitan areas and regional economic development the centerpiece of what you do locally. You don't want every little, I don't know, do you have townships in Wisconsin? Michigan, we do. You don't want every local township to be doing its own economic development thing. You want metropolitan areas to be the centerpiece of local economic development strategy. And then the issue is, are there metropolitan areas that you can define as distressed in terms of overall unemployment and poverty that you can maybe target some extra assistance at? And then within that, as I said, I really think a lot of economic development needs to focus on this area of customized job training. And as part of customized job training, you certainly want to focus on bringing in employment of people who are unemployed. I mean, you know, as I mentioned, like the MEAD program in Minnesota was targeted on providing incentives for hiring the unemployed for new jobs. So I think rather than focusing in per se, one way I put it, I'm not a huge fan of enterprise zones as a concept if enterprise zone is defined as a distressed neighborhood. I'm a big fan of trying to target unemployed workers and workers in poverty who may live in such neighborhoods or may live outside of those neighborhoods for job creation. And I think, you know, places are important, but neighborhoods are not the appropriate venue for really running economic development programs.
Question.
You mentioned trying to get a sense of how these programs all work together. And so I guess I had two questions about that, if you had any research experience about it. One is how well job training centers interact with technical colleges or community colleges, which is something we're dealing with here right now, and sort of models that work well there. And then the other question I have is sort of, you know, we try to do a lot to sort of get businesses started and encourage folks to get going. Do you have a sense of, you know, my concern is we can put a lot of capital into a startup business that gets a really great idea, does the research, gets it off the ground, and then the question then comes, well, where are they going to do their manufacturing? And then they might get a great offer from another state to set up their manufacturing elsewhere. Are there tools along that line to sort of, get companies from inception to the manufacturing line to actually stay in a location, especially if you're investing a lot of public resources to get them going?
So the first question was dealing with trying to coordinate what technical colleges did with the local area. Are there good models for that? Actually, you know, North Carolina is one of the leading models in that area. That, as I understand it, again, I don't want to get too controversial, but they have a statewide community college system that's coordinated, and they essentially, anyone who starts up a new manufacturing business in North Carolina gets free training and screening, which is pretty comprehensive and, involves essentially the community college almost becoming an adjunct of the personnel department of the company. I mean, they actually will go out and help select who goes through the training, help the company screen the folks, help do the training up to the company's specifications, so it's kind of a one-stop shop type of service. And that's done in North Carolina as a good model. Massachusetts also has a very good incumbent worker training program. There's a very good paper written on this by one of my colleagues at the Institute, Kevin Hollenbeck, which will describe the Massachusetts program in more detail. If you don't remember that name, just email me. I'll give you send you a copy of the paper. So I think there are some very good models of how this can be done. I think one of the issues that is, I would hope legislators would think about is how do you give incentives to people to do these things? In other words, I think that state community colleges, technical colleges, universities, personnel in them respond to incentives just like everyone else, and so you need to figure out ways of creating incentives for if you want the technical colleges to do more in customized job training and do a better job of it, you need to think about how do you create the carrots that will encourage them to do that. The second question you had was with how do you just go? That's a real problem, and that's actually one thing I would say. One reason why technology transfer is sometimes problematic from universities is that it ends up being a lot of it's outsourced, and that's true. Which is one reason why I would say that you need to place as much emphasis on working with existing business in the area. I mean, why might you stick around once you started the business up? Okay, you might stick around if, in fact, the university and technical college system provided new quality workers to your business on a regular basis, and if you could get low cost or free consulting on a regular basis from university faculty. So you need to think about creating a system that helps existing business in the area. Otherwise, you'll be funding all these startups, and if there's not the incentives to stay there as an existing business, why would you stick around? So I think it may be more important to figure out how to set up the system so that the existing high-tech businesses get the kind of supports they need as to simply try to fund technology transfer.